there is a fair amount of chaos and a vacuum, really, in terms of communication between the branches of government.
State officials grapple with accessing Alaska's share of stimulus funding. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 23rd of February. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, an infraction that could help decide the winner of the Yukon Quest.
You know, a willful act like this to enhance your own position is not acceptable.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
The Alaska Morning News is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The University of Alaska Fairbanks now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Begin your UAF fisheries degree at any major University of Alaska campus and finish in Fairbanks or Juneau. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
Besides nearly $800 billion tucked into the economic stimulus package President Obama signed last week, state and federal officials see deadlines they have to meet in to share in the distribution. The federal plan is designed to put money into the national economy quickly, and in many cases, states face a use-it-or-lose-it decision. Alaska faces the same time constraints, and the most asked question at the Capitol in Juneau is, are we ready? APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
States will share about $342 billion. Alaska expects $844 million as of right now. And the state's first deadline for getting money is March 10th, only 2 weeks away. It's for transportation projects that can begin immediately. John Tomasian with the National Governors Association last week gave his group a clear message. He says the states need to plan their policy and accounting procedures for the money, since the White House is expecting transparency.
We're recommending that governors need to appoint a lead coordination and team or council that has expertise, extensive expertise in transparency and accountability.
But while that coordination exists, it's not formally visible in Alaska. It's in the background. Anchorage Republican Senator Liesl McGuire, who this week is in the nation's capital for a meeting of the Council of State Governments, says she's found that all but six states have some structure to deal with the money, and some of them are very well organized.
There is a fair amount of chaos and a vacuum, really, in terms of communication between the branches of government and certainly between stakeholders in our communities and the government.
Many other legislators and local officials are also frustrated with the lack of information available on the stimulus plan. Part of that problem is that the information is still arriving from Washington, D.C., as the deadlines get closer. Here's what we do know so far. Of the state's $844 million, $175 million is for highways and bridges. There's $23 million for clean water projects, $41 million for transit, $226 million for Medicaid, $170 million for education, and $36 million for food stamps. All of that is for use in the next 2 years. The first legislation on the state's program will be made public in a bill this week, outlining the Transportation Department's assessment of what it can use. The Office of Management and Budget is overseeing the administration's response. Director Karen Rehfeld has told each department to find and evaluate its own area of expertise. She says state workers are talking to federal workers, who themselves are still discovering their own requirements. And some state agencies are ahead of others. Rehfeld says there's an 800-page bill, and that's a lot of details.
Federal agencies have some very rigorous timelines that they need to meet in order to get the guidance out to states and to program managers. So there's a huge amount of work that needs to be done, and that's part of the challenge here.
And Larry Pursley on Hawker's staff is overseeing the House finance effort to follow the plan. He says that as the federal requirements come out for programs, the regulations are alongside, and the receiving agency will have to adapt, whether it's the state budget or an independent agency or a federal agency. Pursley and Rehfeld both say there will likely be several new budgets, and there will be amendments to the existing budgets that are now before the legislature. The goal is to keep up with the federal requirements, including the deadlines that are getting closer. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
The standings in the Yukon Quest sled dog race have shifted dramatically in the last 12 hours. Longtime race veteran William Cleeden looked like he had a good shot at winning the race, but he ran into trouble near Eagle Summit, one of the toughest sections of the race, and has dropped back to fifth place. Here to explain it all is KUAC's Dan Bross, who has been reporting from the trail. Hi, Dan.
Hi.
Dan, things seem to have changed a lot in the last day. What happened on the way to Eagle Summit?
Well, it's absolutely crazy. William Cleeden went out up Central, which is the checkpoint prior to this precipitous climb up Eagle Summit, in the lead. He was followed very closely 3 minutes later by Hugh Neff. Those two have been running close most of the second half of the race. And they headed out toward this climb. It's only 28 miles to the next stop, which is a dog drop at mile 101 on the Cease Highway. However, the hours kept ticking by. No one showed up. More mushers were heading out behind them, John Little, Sebastian Schnula, on, and no one was showing up. 14 hours passed this morning until Hugh Neff finally came out of the mountains and into the 101 dog drop, and the news was that William Cleeden's team had quit on the climb and was just sitting there. Later, when successive mushers came through, John Little and later Sebastian Schnula explained that Cleeden's team just wouldn't go. He tried to help the fellow White Horse musher and could not get his team to go. Schnula mushed on, continued on. Later in the morning, reporters, camera crews were all gathered waiting to hear from William Cleeden, and here he comes down the trail, but following Brent Sass, so they really mushed in together. The story was, when Brent came along, William's team parked on the climb, the steepest part of the climb, he went past, secured his team at the top of the summit. This is a very windy, extreme, exposed area, and they have old tires secured into the ground with chains at the summit, so in case you're in trouble, you can tie your team there. Brent Sass, young, strong musher, tied his team up at the summit, ran back down the mountain, grabbed William Cleeden's lead dogs, and basically acted as lead dog, marched them up, William driving, pushing the sled, and got him over the summit. William was able to follow Brent Sass into the mile 101 dog drop, and the race is resumed, but things totally shaken up on Eagle Summit.
Have you had a chance to talk to William Cleeden?
Sure. I mean, he obviously was crushed. He was in the lead, in position to win this race, and it all fell apart for him, and he had a whole lot of time to sit there in the mountains in a very extreme windy environment and see what was slipping out of his hands because his dogs wouldn't go. And we asked him, what happened, William? You had this amazing team that's been so fast through the whole race. And he said his main lead dog, the most experienced one of the team, had gone into heat, and the males on his team would not pay attention. This lead dog would not run forward. He just could not keep them straight and focused, and it was just total chaos for the poor guy. He sat there. He thought about going back. He tried to go back a little ways. That didn't work either. So he was just really stuck until somehow Brent Sass was able to help him get going this morning and move on. When he got to mile 101, which is a remote stop in the mountains, a little cabin, it's a place where mushers can drop dogs that aren't keeping up. He dropped this one female that's in heat, and his team settled down, so hopefully he'll be able to continue on and make some progress.
And, Dan, what's coming up toward the finish?
Well, as they head toward the next checkpoint, which is the final checkpoint, it's about an 82-mile run, but it was very warm in the area today. Temperatures going above freezing in the sun, so tough weather for dogs to run in. But it's an 82-mile run. Then they take a mandatory 8-hour break at a place called Twin Bears, which is about 45 miles outside of Fairbanks. So basically, after that break, it'll be a straight, fairly flat run into town. And 8 hours is a good long time to rest the dogs. For one musher, Hugh Neff, who was first through the last stop there at mile 101, it's going to be a 10-hour break because he got caught yesterday running his team on the road instead of the Quest Trail. And that's illegal. You're supposed to stay on the trail. He was running on a very smooth, icy road and making pretty fast time for about 5 miles. He was spotted doing that, and the race marshal penalized him 2 hours for doing so. That's being tacked on to his mandatory rest at the final checkpoint. So that's going to cost you, even if he gets there first tonight. He's going to have to spend an extra 2 hours there later, and we'll see how that affects the standings.
And Dan, quickly, I understand the Quest race marshal had some fairly harsh words for Hugh Neff. What did he say?
Well, you know, this was a sportsmanship thing. So it wasn't just a matter of, well, maybe he made a mistake and made up a few minutes on William Clayton heading into Central. No, the race marshal said this was intentional and unsportsmanlike, and the penalty was more as much a punishment as it was to compensate for any time that he gained.
When do you think we can expect a winner?
We're looking at, I'm guessing here, because we won't know until they arrive at the final checkpoint how the timing will work out. But if they get there, oh, here in the next 3 or 4 hours, we're probably looking at an early afternoon finish time in Fairbanks tomorrow. So it's still going to be a near record time, despite all the antics on Eagle Summit.
All right. Well, thanks, Dan, for that update.
You're welcome.
KUEC's Dan Brass reporting live from the Yukon Quest Trail. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Alaskans push for national pro-union legislation.
You know, if you can sign up to register to vote by signing a card, why can't you sign up for a union by signing a card?
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. It's never too early to set expectations and goals for your child's education. The UA College Savings Plan provides opportunities that can help you reach your educational savings goals. Save in Alaska, study anywhere. There's more information available by calling 1-888-4, and then Alaska. This message sponsored by the UA College Savings Plan.
More than one-third of Anchorage School District students are above a healthy weight, but a new analysis of 10 years of height and weight data from the district shows obesity rates have leveled off recently. Alaska's chief medical officer is happy to see that trend, but Dr. Jay Butler says obesity is still a huge problem in schools.
One in five kids in high school and in middle school in Anchorage meet that definition of obesity. The good news is that the trend is that we seem to be seeing a bit of a plateauing. So I think the really good take home here is some of what we're doing appears to be making a difference.
How does that 20% sounds incredibly high? How does that compare to the general population, to the average citizen in Alaska?
Well, rates of obesity among adults in Alaska are actually a little worse. Over 25% of adults in Alaska are considered obese based on a body mass index of above 30, which for someone who is 5'10" is over 207 pounds.
The number of normal weight students decreased significantly in the first half of the study period. Do you have any sense of why that happened?
Well, because there's no controlled studies here, all we can do is look at what was done and what the effect was. It's hard to attribute a direct cause and effect. But during the period, a couple things happened. Early on, after the initial report showing the increasing rates, the state established an obesity prevention and control program in the Division of Public Health, and there was specific partnership developed with the school districts. For instance, there was a prohibition of selling soda and junk food in schools, which I know some people felt like was the state and the school district being the health Nazis. But fact is, there are just multiple reports of people being able to control their obesity, control diabetes even, by reducing exposure to soda and junk food. Additionally, during the past 2 years, the school district has revised the elementary school curriculum to include more time for health instruction as well as physical education.
What would need to happen to put a significant dent in this obesity figure? I know that you've said that the good news is it's sort of leveled off, but what would need to happen to really drive that down?
Well, we really need to recognize that obesity is the major health problem in the United States today. When we look at the cost of health care, 16% of the gross domestic product in the United States goes to health care now, and that's continued to increase. there are various estimates on how much of that's driven by the obesity epidemic. But when we look at just the costs in Alaska, it's very impressive that we're talking about very short-term skyrocketing expenses. I'd use, for an example, Medicaid expenditures on treatment of type 2 diabetes in children in Alaska. They have more than doubled over the past 4 years. Type 2 diabetes is what we used to call adult onset diabetes because we never saw it in children. Very rare because there just wasn't the level of obesity that we see now.
Dr. Butler, in general, how big is the problem of obesity in the Anchorage schools? How does it affect the students' ability to learn and to interact with others? And just generally, how large is this problem?
Well, it's a huge problem. There's data showing an association between obesity in childhood and poor academic performance. And while it's very hard to assess cause and effect in that relationship, it's much more clear that kids who are obese are at risk for diabetes, hypertension, high cholesterol, orthopedic problems, psychosocial problems, and also obesity in adulthood. Additionally, 1 in 10 adults who have diabetes are disabled, and that's more than 4 times higher than the rate of disability in the general population. So not only is obesity making our kids more sick, less able to be healthy adults, but also less able to work and be productive.
Dr. Jay Butler is Alaska's chief medical officer. Alaska Senator Mark Begich is a co-sponsor of the Employees Free Choice Act, introduced in the U.S. Senate by Massachusetts Senator Ted Kennedy. But Senator Lisa Murkowski says the legislation won't get her support unless she sees substantial changes from the current proposal. The legislation is a top priority of labor unions nationwide, including those with members in Alaska. KTOO's Rosemary Alexander reports.
The proposal would amend the National Labor Relations Act to make it easier for public and private sector workers to form or join labor unions. A similar bill died in the U.S. Senate in 2007. Both Murkowski and former Senator Ted Stevens voted against it. Representative Don Young voted for it. This year, Murkowski is one of several Senate Republicans being targeted by labor unions who know they will need at least a few swing votes to get the bill out of the Senate. Barbara Soffel is Assistant Director of Legislation for the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees in Washington, D.C.
We know that the Republican leadership will invoke a filibuster, so that means we have to get 60 votes. And we think that there are some senators that we can go to on the Republican side who will stand up for working families and support this legislation. And we think that Senator Murkowski, representing the interests of the people of Alaska, should embrace this piece of legislation.
Murkowski says, not so fast. While in Alaska last week, she told state lawmakers she has no plans to support the legislation if it looks like the 2007 version.
The Employee Free Choice Act, EFCA, is what we affectionately call it. As it is drafted now, I'm not supportive of. There's a couple of provisions. One would take away the right to secret ballot in attempts to organize. And then there's some arbitration provisions that I think are difficult and problematic for us at this point in time. I will tell you, it will be a partisan showdown.
Under the proposal, an employer would be legally required to recognize and bargain with a workers' union if a majority of employees vote to form a union by signing authorization cards. If at least a third of workers want an election, they can ask the National Labor Relations Board to call it. AFSCME political director Larry Scanlon puts it this way.
If you can sign up for a political party by signing a card, you know, if you can sign up to register to vote by signing a card, why can't you sign up for a union by signing a card?
The proposal calls for mediation if a new union and employer are unable to reach agreement on a first contract within 90 days. If there's still no resolution, the dispute goes to binding arbitration. Scanlon says this is an important provision. Studies show that 44% of newly certified unions fail to get a first contract. EFCA also includes mandatory injunctions for unfair labor practices during organizing efforts. Murkowski says she understands the difficulty of union organizing.
What I have been trying to urge throughout is we recognize that the way that system is now is not a perfect system, that there is coercion, intimidation, unfortunately, by both sides. So what is it that we could do that would be specific to addressing that coercion that does go on and work to eliminate that?
As Senator Murkowski was holding a news conference inside the state capitol Thursday, about 300 state workers were on the steps below shouting their support for the Employees' Free Choice Act. They didn't change her mind. She told reporters she has no plans to support EFCA unless it is substantially rewritten. But the rally is just a warm-up. The Alaska State Employees Association is asking its 8,000 members to write, call, and email Murkowski to support the legislation. In Juneau, I'm Rosemarie Alexander.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by STEMS, where thoughts are sent with flowers and gifts can be blooming with color and aroma. STEMS in Anchorage at 907-563-3366.
Governor Sarah Palin's spokesman Bill McAllister told reporters today that media coverage scrutinizing the governor's per diem expenses for staying in her Wasilla area home has been so relentless it required a response. McAllister said the stories have implied the governor's actions were wrong, but he says they were perfectly legal. He says when the first family does not stay in the governor's Juneau home, there are cost savings.
At the governor's house, everything is paid for by the state. Groceries, utilities, and so on. When the first family is not there, much of this cost is not incurred. In addition, the governor laid off the chef at the house permanently, and there are other salary reductions when she's not there.
McAllister reminded reporters that Palin's predecessor, Frank Murkowski, had an Anchorage apartment rented for him by the state, and Governor Tony Knowles stayed in a hotel. He says Palin has saved a lot of money in housing expenses.
Through her approach to expenses, Governor Palin, in the first 2 years of her term, saved more than $900,000, okay? $900,000 in state funds compared to the last 2 years under her predecessor. This figure accounts for and includes the $17,000 in per diem that she incurred over a two-year period while away from her duty station that has been reported on so often now.
McAllister was careful to note that the governor is not critical of how her predecessor handled these expenses. He says they are only citing the figures for context. He says the savings extend to Governor Palin's husband, Todd, as well. McAllister says while Nancy Murkowski was considered a senior advisor to her husband, there seems to be a double standard applied to Todd Palin.
Well, the former first lady was not questioned about her role in helping Governor Murkowski, we have found that Mr. Palin attracts criticism for showing any interest in state government. He has much to offer, and this criticism is unwarranted.
McAllister says Todd Palin's expenses over a two-year period were under $20,000 compared to more than $79,000 for Mrs. Murkowski. Herring may be one of the most heated issues before the Alaska Board of Fisheries as meetings continue this week in Sitka. The Sitka Tribe of Alaska has three proposals before the board. KCAW's Bonnie Sue Hitchcock reports.
Chip Trinan of the Sitka Herring Association, a marketing group for the permit holders of the Sitka Sound Sacro herring fishery, says there probably won't be consensus about any proposal that seeks to shut down a fishery completely.
We certainly aren't going to agree to anything like that. Unless we were convinced that there was some reason that the stocks were in jeopardy.
About a quarter of the 200 testimonies before the Board of Fish last week dealt with herring. Floyd Tompkins urged the board to take more precautionary measures in its management, such as a cap on the sacro seine harvest or reducing the maximum harvest to 15% of the biomass.
Precaution is warranted because of inadequately explained changes in age class composition, increased whale predation, the need for biomass valuation based on more dimensions of measurement than are now available, and for that, increased funding should be supplied to local fish and game.
Heather Mary Woody, a research biologist for Sitka Tribe of Alaska, testified that she thinks the minimum conservation threshold of 20,000 tons set in 1997 is too low.
I recommend the threshold be raised to 30,000 to 40,000 tons, which accounts for ecosystem requirements, changing environmental conditions and life history characteristics, all consumptive uses, and the low recruitment levels.
Several Tlingit elders as well as local residents testified that they've seen radical changes over the years in the local herring stocks, especially east of town where herring was once abundant. Many said that they could not meet their subsistence requirements, and some were unable to harvest any eggs at all. Jim Marcotte, executive director of the Alaska Board of Fisheries, says these testimonies are just one aspect of the process. He says while the Department of Fish and Game handles management and biology issues related to fisheries, deciding allocation is then a matter of public policy, which is the role of the Board of Fisheries.
And allocation takes place between subsistence uses, which actually in state law has the highest priority of any of those consumptive uses, but also with commercial uses, sport uses, guided sport uses, and personal use.
A proposal that would require subsistence harvesters to obtain a commercial permit in order to better track subsistence use by the department did not receive support from tribal members in a committee working group over the weekend. Two other proposals, to establish an equal shares fishery for Sitka Sound sacro herring and one to establish an equal share quota, were both met with considerable discussion during the committee working group. Bob Thorstenson with the Sitka Herring Association says he thinks the state management of herring has been fabulous. But he says if there are groups like the Ketchikan Herring Association that feel the fishery is detrimental to the stock in some way, an equal split fishery would be a compromise that might work for everyone.
An equal split fishery is going to be managed a lot smoother. You're going to be able to see things a lot easier. It makes a lot more sense. And finally, this ends up saying your role is to conserve and develop fisheries. And some people have been saying you can't do equal split because it's going to be some kind of an economic dislocation or some kind of economic situation. This is conservation and development, and the board has the mandate to do this.
Another factor in favor of the equal split fishery is safety. Several testimonies noted that the derby-style openings are so dangerous, they're a, quote, feeding frenzy for lawsuits. Southeast herring fisheries are worth a combined total of about $18 million to the state. In Sitka, I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross on the Yukon Quest Trail, Rosemary Alexander in Juneau, and Bonnie Sue Hitchcock in Sitka. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide insurance coverage for Alaskans who may feel they have become uninsurable. It offers hope to people with certain high-risk chronic illnesses or those who have exhausted employer-based insurance, and to some under 65-year-olds who are Medicare eligible. Find out more. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. More information at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. It's never too early to set expectations and goals for your child's education. The UA College Savings Plan provides opportunities that can help you reach your educational savings goals. Save in Alaska, study anywhere. There's more information available by calling 1-888-4 and then Alaska. This message sponsored by the UA College Savings Plan.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.